So I noticed a few minutes ago when I checked my watch really carefully, and probably nobody even saw me do it, that I remembered that last week I let you out 5 minutes early, so this week, guess what? So get comfortable, relax, it's all good. You never know with joys and sorrows. We have lots to share, so, you know, there's always a little give and take. There's a story that the Reverend Jean Nuyar tells in her book, Fluent in Faith, about a young child at Ferry Beach. For those of you who may know Ferry Beach, it's a camp center right on the coast of Maine, just over the border from New Hampshire. They have conferences, week-long conferences, all, you know, every week of the summer. So this child sat in a circle of children and adults as a wise and bearded patriarch of the conference center told a little of its history. It's called Ferry Beach, he said, because 100 years ago, ferries used to come from Portland and land on this shore. You know, ferries, F-E-R-R-I-E-S. Days later, this child argued with some other children. There are so such things as ferries. Ray said so, and they used to land on this beach. There is something in each of us that longs for the mysterious, don't you think? For the slightly magical and poetically mystical. From our youngest days, stories capture our imaginations and offer us a way to understand the myriad things we long to understand. Why is the sky blue? Or how many grains of sand might there be on this beach? Why did my fish die? When is Dad coming home? Are fairies real? Where is my tooth then? Or is there such a thing as God? And we know that these thoughts or their possible answers don't come in isolation, even when we're very young. They don't spring up within us from nothing. Diane Satterfield, who is a novelist and storyteller, reminds us, a birth is not really a beginning. Our lives at the start are not really our own, but only the continuation of someone else's story. We may be internally new at birth, the whole idea of tabula rasa, for example, but by the time we have words to put our thoughts into form, we have been impressed, shaped, and nurtured within the context of beliefs and opinions, particular to our environments. Think for a moment about the particular setting you grew up in. How has it shaped your thinking? How has it inclined your curiosity or how you go about making sense of the world we live in? As we get a little bit older and begin to individuate, as we become ourselves, it is this early environment that we either embrace or push back against. Maybe we do need to rebel against our origins, as our friend Alicia Ostreicher suggested. Maybe not. Either way, I think she's right. Growing up and changing is not that simple. It's more mysterious how we become, what paths attract us, and what paths don't. The point is that we all started somewhere. We began as something, and out of something, we are something new. The lantern has always been there. We carry it with us, even as we search for new light. And as Raymond John Bond suggested in our reading earlier, in our maturing and our searching, in our looking for the perennial something new, which is what happens when we're willing to make sure we're not stuck, there's music and there's love and wit and something that can lift the mind. I would argue also something that can lift the soul. We can trust that the light is not false or foreign when we go towards wonder, he suggests. The meaning is in the search, said Jacob. Okay, that's all good, but here's the question. How do we talk about it? How can we as a community of faith have conversations about our spiritual journeys? It's not easy. I imagine you know that. I, for one, think about ultimate questions all the time, but ironically don't have nearly as many conversations about it as one might think. Unless, of course, it's the search committee, but that's behind us now. It is tricky to talk about how we make sense of the world. It's easy enough to say what we don't believe in, but what does make sense to us? And even though we are a non-creedal tradition and all coming from different places, we tend to make assumptions in community life about our commonalities, which is why we need to talk about it to begin with. We see this in Unitarian Universalist congregations all the time, particularly around our spiritual identities. Congregations tend to identify themselves as particularly one way or another, and there can be clues in our orders of service, in the things we choose to include or not in our worship services, or in what we choose to teach our children. Next week, I want to be more specific about something that I think we have let fall by the wayside in our nascent tradition. But for today, I want to challenge us more generally to consider how we share our various individual discoveries, how we go about creating of the something that we already are, the something new that we might become for a time until we become something new again. In terms of our collective identity, our congregational identity, you may be aware of how we generalize, right? So that group down the road, that group is very Christian. And that one over there, that congregation, they have a large pagan influence. And that one is very humanist. They'll never talk about God or Jesus. And that one has a lot of Buddhists. We tend to be this way, and most people here tend to be. Unless, of course, they don't tend to be that way, but how would we know? It's curious to me that we Unitarian Universalists who represent ourselves as open to all, wherever you are on your spiritual journey, that's not just here, by the way, they say that in every congregation, seem to have such trouble with theological conversations and theological diversity. Perhaps it shouldn't surprise me. Because even among my colleagues, it is tricky to talk about matters of the spirit. In 1994, Carl Scoville gave an address at the Berry Street Lecture, which is a gathering of professional religious leaders. He said, "I address you, my peers, whose business, like mine, is soul business, and who choose to stand at the uneasy boundary between the divine and the human, the holy and the humane. For there, on that boundary, we are constantly tempted in our loneliness to domesticate the divine, to make it easy, common, saleable, eventually irrelevant. As colleagues, we face another danger, namely to share with each other only the tales, technology, strategy, and sociability of our trade, and sharing only that, leave each other lonely in that one realm which has touched us most profoundly, the realm of the soul, the realm of the spirit. It's been my experience often that professional religious leaders get together and talk about how their congregation has grown. One would not mention if it had not. They talk about what new methods of preaching we've found most effective. I went to a seminar last year called Preaching from the Heart, which was about extemporaneous preaching, as though the written word is somehow not from the heart. We talk about social media, and if you don't have a blog or you're not on Twitter, well, it may be true then that your congregation is not growing. Don't think for a minute that UU ministers are not competitive or that we have an easier time somehow talking about matters of the spirit. We would, of course, like all of us, not want to offend. I did attend one regular meeting of colleagues where we opened with the questions, how is it with your spirit today? And where have you experienced the holy? That was the exception to the rule, but I found it especially refreshing. I want this place to be a place where those questions are welcome. I want us to be a place where traditionally religious words are accepted in the spirit in which they are offered, hopefully with expansiveness and inclusive intent, not as requirements of belief, but as frames for our senses of wonder and curiosity. I hope I can say God and know that you will not bristle, or talk about sin, which is tricky. Do we wonder about grace? There are harder ones, of course. Salvation, for example, communion, mercy, blessing. Do any of us trip over those? It might be useful to have a bit of brief history to get some context for those of you who are less familiar with our Unitarian Universalist trajectory. Our traditions merged, you'll recall, in 1961, the Unitarians bringing their truth of one being, not three, but one spirit, one source. The Universalists bringing their truth of all-encompassing love, of universal salvation, not selected or earned necessarily. We weathered the early years of social upheaval in the 60s no less turbulently than the rest of society. For some congregations, the passing of the brass cross on the altar, now more often called the chancel table, was a defining event. For others, new fellowships, perhaps, the freedom to eschew traditional terms like sanctuary, substituting meeting room, for example, even substituting congregation for church, which felt a little too Christian. These have always been good faith efforts, no doubt, to make space that welcomes all in an open exploration of ideas and community. Often our new fellowships were brought together in an effort to provide the constructs for children, all these children we saw earlier, framing religious community in a way that would not encumber our young ones with preconceived notions and structures that felt tired or worn or even wrong. This newly merged tradition, focused on justice, on doing works in the world, being the hands that labored to address inequalities, which is all good. At some point, I think, we started to discern a missing link. The question being, what differentiated our gatherings from justice-seeking nonprofit work in general? In what way did we understand ourselves to be communities of faith? Just 10 short years ago, in 2004, Meville Lombard Press published a collection of essays called The Language of Reverence. It references a term reoriented from one used by humanist minister, the Reverend David Bumbaugh, who was asking for a vocabulary of reverence. The dialogue in the book, Language of Reverence, revolves around two big questions. Are we talking about religion in a way that is adequate to our needs as a religious community? And what are we talking about when we talk about religion? The humanist minister David Bumbaugh suggested in his 2001 essay that the development of a language that did not return us to traditional theological terms was to be preferred, but instead one that was rooted in the vision of reality and of humanity's place in the world that is emerging from the natural sciences. In response, Bill Sinkford, who was president of the UUA at the time, delivered a sermon in 2003 that bounced off of Bumbaugh's idea, but in a slightly more traditional direction. Religious language, Sinkford said, doesn't have to mean God talk. And added, I'm not suggesting that Unitarian Universalism return to traditional Christian language. Still, his own 45-second elevator speech about Unitarian Universalism upset some among us because it did use God talk. So a more recent book has been published by Skinner House Books, the one I referenced earlier, called Fluent in Faith. It matters what we believe, Nuyar writes, and it matters that others understand what those beliefs are. A non-creedal faith is often misunderstood to mean that its adherents have no shared beliefs at all. This misconception weakens us as individuals and as a gathered body of faith. An open faith need not be an empty faith, she says. An open well gives and receives, but it is not empty. An open heart is not an empty heart. We're a young tradition. This year, just 53 years in the forming. We have been described as being in a period of adolescence, the suggestion being that we continue to wrestle with differentiating ourselves from our parental influences, just the way our poet explained this morning. And it's likely we are all aware that numerical age is kind of irrelevant when it comes to those emotional responses, right? We can be 95 years old and still feel that familiar response to our parental influence. My hope is that we are becoming less reactive as a tradition and more nuanced, more like 17 or 18 year olds, perhaps. No offense intended to the 13 year olds. Perhaps we are becoming better able to draw what is useful from our past, from its stories and its language, and integrate it into our evolving ways of understanding the world. Perhaps we're getting better at culling the richness from the something that we started with and crafting it into the something new. I want to be able to use religious language from this pulpit, traditional and otherwise, and have it be understood that my intention is that the river of meaning be very wide. Not so wide that you can't cross over it, but wide enough that all will feel invited into a place of their own comfort. I agree with Raymond Bon when he suggests the light's not false or foreign when we go towards wonder. Last week, I offered you an invitation to savor and serve together a world that so badly needs to be both appreciated and healed. Here's another invitation to a conversation about language, about religious language, that will both include and inspire. I hope we can be both gentle and fearless in our experimenting, clear and open in our responses. Let's be people with lanterns, always looking together for the light. So may it be. And amen.